This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. To many people, Detroit is a symbol of urban decay. In the new book, Detroit, An American Autopsy, our guest, journalist Charlie LaDuff, writes, "It is awful here. But I believe that Detroit is America's city. It was the vanguard of our way up, just as it is the vanguard of our way down. And, one hopes, the vanguard of our way up again." Unquote. LaDuff grew up in a blue-collar suburb of Detroit and found his way to New York, where he spent 12 years at the New York Times. He shared a Pulitzer Prize while at the Times in 2001, but since then has returned to Detroit, where he now is a TV reporter for the local Fox affiliate. The website Deadline Detroit wrote that LaDuff has thrown out the rules of how to be a TV reporter. He doesn't comb his hair every day and almost never dresses up. He stares into the camera and makes funny faces. On camera, he wears sunglasses and talks with a swagger, referring to the mayor as Dave and the county executive as Bob. LaDuff spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, Charlie LaDuff, welcome to Fresh Air.
I've always wanted to be here. Thanks.
Well, it's good to have you. You know, I know a lot of journalists, and practically every one of them would give anything for a job at the New York Times. You were there a lot of years. You shared in a Pulitzer Prize. You walked away from the Times to do freelancing and eventually return to Detroit and work at the Detroit News. Why?
Well, first of all, let me correct you there. I was not a journalist. I'm a reporter.
Okay.
And the difference is a journalist can type without looking. And I had a good run there at the New York Times. I loved it. I'm a Times man. I'm always going to be a Times man. But I kind of got tired. It's a difficult place. It's a hard place to let your personality and flair come into the copy. They're known for other things. And actually, I had my first daughter. I was stationed in the Los Angeles Bureau of the New York Times. I covered the West. It was great. I crossed the desert with migrants. I went to the Bunny Ranch and outside of Vegas with my wife and an old lady photographer. It was, you know, really pretty cool life. But then we had the kid, and I noticed something. I noticed that I didn't belong in L.A. I had a daughter. We didn't belong to anybody. We weren't connected to anyone. It was just to get to a park, you had to cross two major boulevards. And I pictured my daughter at 14 with a halter top and blue mascara walking up and down Melrose. And I said, it's just not where we're from. And I thought that we should, my wife and I, that she's also from Detroit, that we should just cash it in and come home. So our daughter would have some root and some structure and know her grandparents and her 20 cousins and her aunts and uncles. And I don't regret it in the least.
Anybody who does a little work on YouTube can find some great stuff that you've done, some real investigative reporting. There was one on a sledge hauler and his questionable connections and practices, which it has some terrific stuff and some very, very creative and funny things. But I thought we would listen to a bit of another piece of yours that got a lot of attention, where you decided to golf through the city of Detroit, an 18-mile course where you were going to hit a ball, go there, play it, and keep playing. Where did this idea come from?
I think what it was my brothers had played golf like the Saturday before, and it was just one of those dog day summer mornings, and I'm driving to work like, I need a story. And I just think because I was talking to my brothers about their golf game the previous day or before, I said, let me just golf the city. Let's just knock a ball through the whole entire city and see how empty it is and who's out there. And we did. We did. It took 2 days, 100 degrees, 18 miles.
Let's listen to a little bit of that report.
Right from the get-go, I'm realizing this here might be the stupidest idea I've ever had. It's 100 degrees, I'm wearing black, and I can't golf. But I'm committed because they're talking to reinventing this city. What does that mean with millions in budget cuts? What does a city even really look like block by block? Who lives here? What do they want? What do they need? Has anybody asked them? Besides, how many cities are so empty you can take a full-on swing? Right away, I run into trouble. I lost my ball in the weeds on Robinwood Street. This lady lost her daughter.
I'm trying to kill herself. Yeah.
No shoes on. She's in one of their three houses.
What is she doing?
She's killing herself.
How do you know?
Because she took all the pills I own.
And that's Charlie LaDuff from his one of his TV reports in Detroit, where he's now a reporter. He has a new book called Detroit, An American Autopsy. In that case, you're whacking your ball through a semi-abandoned neighborhood, and there's a woman who's trying to find her daughter, who she says is going to take all her pills and kill herself. What became of the daughter, do you know?
Yeah, they found her. I had a golf game, man. I couldn't be there all day. You know, I got to make 18 miles. Oh, by the way, I set a course record, 2,525 strokes. I dare any of your listeners to beat that. Okay, but anyway, I am a human. That woman could have been my aunt. My sister was that kind of girl that, you know, went missing. So I care. So I flagged down some cops. We called some that I knew because, you know, man, at some point, you're not a reporter anymore. I don't know about this. I have to maintain my objectivity. I'm a human being. So called a few guys. They found her. She wasn't dead. She wasn't even high. And happy ending to that story.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Charlie LaDuff. He worked at the New York Times and at the Detroit News. He's now an innovative TV reporter for Fox 2 in Detroit, and he has a book called Detroit, An American Autopsy. You write a fair amount about your family in this book. You want to just describe a bit about the neighborhood you grew up in, what kind of family you had, what kind of community?
Like I said, my mom's been married three times, so we moved around, but I'll just get to the point in the book. I grew up a blue-collar suburb about 2 miles from the city limits of Detroit on a very busy intersection. My mom worked very, very long days, 16-hour days in her flower shop on the east side of Detroit, commuting every day. Her husband, my stepfather at the time, he sort of freelanced being a dad sometimes, and that one came apart. So it was five of us all the time, latchkey kids, just trying to, you know, hold on. Like, we weren't raised in a ghetto by any means. We had books in our home. We had religion. We had dinner at 6 until I was about 9 years old, and the dinner stopped. And then things started to sort of fall apart.
Was that because your mom was working nights?
Yeah, so it's a toxic mix, I think. No father, mother working, young teenagers looking after children. It's not a good recipe for success, although we all are successes in our own right, and I'm very proud to be from my family.
And I know you had some wild years as a youngster, but went to school, right, got into journalism.
I was the only one of my siblings who graduated high school, you know, by the time I was 18. My brother went back after his military service and got his college degree. But yeah, I got lucky. I really did. I wasn't working in a screw factory or nothing wrong with that. But, you know, if you've ever been in one, it's not a nice place to work. And, you know, I don't stock beer shelves, which is cool. But if you've ever stocked a beer shelf, it's a hard thing to look at for the length of your life. And that's kind of what we have left in America, I think. We really blew it.
You say you were lucky.
Yeah.
In what way? I mean, why were you able to finish college? And
I think when my mom was going through that second divorce, I was not a female like my sister. I was not young like my brothers. I was, I don't know, about 14. So I was sort of formed, if you know what I'm saying. I wasn't doing drugs. You know, I was turned off by them, watching my sister and her crowd. I had a good group of friends, so the stars just aligned for me where I had a support group, you know, and my sister didn't, and my brothers were young, and I think hurt a little bit by the circumstance, but we're all really close to our mom because we realize now who she was and what she was doing. She was, you know, she was being everything, and so I got off to college like my mom wanted me to.
Your sister, Nicole, is a painful story here. Do you want to talk about her as a young person and tell us what happened?
You read it. Ask me something, man. That's you're asking me.
Okay, okay.
You know?
What are your memories of her as a teenager?
She was beautiful, really a gorgeous girl. you know, like an oval face and high cheekbones and long brunette hair. And every boy dreamed of her. And she was wild. She hung out with older boys. They did a lot of dope when mom was gone at the flower shop. My mom had a very big heart, and so that crowd was a lot of runaways. So we always had somebody staying over, somebody sleeping out front in their car. And something happened with my sister. She just got lost to the streets. She hooked part-time, you know, sometimes as a prostitute. And then she'd come out of her stupor, and she'd clean up. And then she'd serve, you know, eggs and bacon to men. And my sister wasn't about that. You know, I mean, I think she just, that wasn't going to be her life. And that has to hurt, because then what else does she know? You know, like, I can't make this. This doesn't fulfill me. I don't have any skills. And then she'd fall into depression and go back out to the street. And eventually they killed her. Eventually they killed her. And the place where she died, that's the one place on planet Earth I've been to war zones. Like I told you, I was in the desert. I've been to five continents by myself. I could never go back to that corner. Just hurt.
Well, you describe in the book how you would drive many blocks away just to avoid the neighborhood where she died. And we'll just say she died in a traffic accident after a night of partying, I guess. But you saw it as the result of the life that she had led. You describe
Want to hear how she died? She got into a car with a strange man, and he was doing 80 down a residential street. And it's basically like kidnapping, as I see it. And she jumped right out of the car going 80 right into a tree.
There's
I know right where that tree's at.
Yeah,
I visit that tree now. I'm over it.
There's a touching story in the book of your mother after the death of your sister, Nicole, wanting to come to terms with it and see that place. Can you describe that moment?
When we went to the bar?
Yeah.
Can I say something to your brother before? This is like kind of, I never really talked out loud about it.
You don't have to. I mean,
It's okay. I just want to share if I'm feeling something. Anyway, so my mom had to see what my sister's life was like after she was gone, and we went to the bar. It's called The Flame. It's where the hookers and the rough guys and dope dealers hung out. And we went in there. She had her raccoon coat on, as she always did when she went to rescue her kids, it seemed, because we all messed up, and she'd always come find us. And she wanted an amaretto and coffee in this dump. Amaretto, much less coffee, please. So we all had whiskey, and a woman came over wanting to know what we were doing in there. We got a weird feeling, my brother and I, but my mom said my daughter used to come here. And the woman asked, "Who's your daughter?" And she said, "Nicole." And that's all you had to say in that place, because we didn't pay for a drink the rest of the night. Whatever you're going to think about people like my sister or your own relatives out there, you have them. Wherever she went, her crowd had respect for her. There's something dignified in every human being. And when people ask me why I write about the things I write about, that's why, because I come from that. And there is dignity in everybody.
You know, the title of the book, An American Autopsy, suggests that the city is dead beyond revival. It's not the way you see it, is it?
No, but it's half dead, yeah. That title, it means a lot of things, I think, the subtitle. It's also anatomy, okay? So when you open up a cadaver, you notice, you know, what's connected to the spine, to the hips, to the legs. And so I'm trying to look at Detroit holistically. The politics, the suits. Our masters of the universe are not brokers. They're car executives. The union man, black, white. I'm doing that. Number two, I'm also saying, and I believe this, that Detroit is the bellwether for America. Why is Philadelphia interested in Detroit because Philadelphia is wondering if it's going to be Detroit. And in a lot of ways, Philadelphia is Detroit. And so I don't mean that as an anthem to a dead city, but it's almost there. But the people are alive. And we're getting down to the nitty-gritty of fixing it. Everybody asks me, what's the future here? And I say, we have coherent auto companies. We have the busiest trade corridor on the continent with Canada. We have all the fresh water in the world. We have great hospitals and a tech center. We're well positioned. But none of that is going to flower until we weed the garden today of these sludge contracts and all the cheating and robbing and killing. Forget the future. Focus on the present. And if we don't, then yes, we will completely be dead.
Do you see progress in the politics of the city?
I do, because guess what? Our former mayor, his defense team just rested, so his corruption trial is now up in the jury's hands. Corruption trial. We had one. We have a federal investigation into our county government. I mean, the feds are hanging more paper here than an interior decorator. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So we're starting to clean this joint out, which has never been clean. The white people here like to say it started with Coleman Young, the first black mayor 40 years ago. But for 100 years, this place has been corrupt. But money covers a lot of sin. There's no more money left. Time to fix it.
You write about your brother, Billy, who at one point in the book worked in a screw factory. And he's, you know, an interesting an example of somebody making their way in this city. You want to just talk a little bit about what he was doing there and kind of where he's
Billy,
going?
Billy is every white middle-class man nightmare because everybody's afraid of having it and then losing it. But Billy's tough, and Billy's building it again. But long and the short, Billy was selling those crap subprime loans, moving paper.
He worked for a mortgage broker or something?
Yep. And he was good at it, man. He, you know, like I said, he didn't graduate high school, but that guy's a number sharp. And he'd make $75,000 a year working 3 days a week. He was that good. And then pop, bust, gone. And he gets a job in a screw factory that his wife hooks him up with. And he's thinking, factory, sweet, union, great pension, sick days, great. You know, nope. $8.50 an hour. And that's it. And stand over there and inhale those fumes and, you know, suck up those mineral spirits. And it was horrible. And I was talking to my brother the other day about it. He goes, you know, the only way to make time pass was to actually work, which made the lifers in the factory mad because they knew he wasn't staying and he was upsetting the balance, which is, you know, drag it out and drag it out. And so one day the boss made my brother clean the toilets. My brother said, what? He went and cleaned the toilets, and somebody wrote some graffiti intended for him, which says, you know, I'll paraphrase it for radio, you know, hard workers suck. And my brother's like, man, this is what went wrong. This is what went wrong in America. Like, we had everything. You didn't have to be educated. Go to the factory. If you don't like it, quit. Go across the street. There's another great paying job. You got a powerboat. You have a vacation home on the lake. It was awesome. And then we woke up this generation, and the music has stopped, and there's no chair. And that's what Billy's all about.
So is he still at the factory?
No. Then he got another job as a salesman. He lost that one, and he's training now for a new job, I believe, the Yellow Pages, something like that. But Billy's a winner, you know. They grow him tough on Joy Road, which is where we come from, and Billy's got three teenage kids, you know what I mean? He's a good father, doing what he's got to do. Maybe not his dream, but his dream is to have a good children. So I guess he's making it, isn't he?
It seems like you're having a ball doing your TV reporting in Detroit and shining a light on things in the city that need it. Your daughter is how old now?
6.
Yeah. I mean, what kind of future do you picture for her in Detroit?
I don't know, man. You know, I don't know. But all I know is this. She sees me on TV and she, who's that bad man, Papa? What did he do? What is government, Papa? Why were you yelling at that government man, Pops? Said because we the people ask him to take care of the money for the roads and the school buses, and he's not doing it. Oh, that's not good, Pops, is it? I said, no, darling, it's really not. So I'm going to do everything I can till the Lord takes my last breath. It's going to be better than this. And, you know, my friend, for the first time in my life, I actually believe in journalism as a force for good. Not that I have any answers or solutions, but, you know, there's a basic minimum standard of which people should be able to live, like having an ambulance show up to your house on time, having a fire truck show up to your home that actually can pump water, having your home broken into and not have to wait around for 8 hours for the police. At minimum, we deserve better than that. And I can honestly look at my daughter and say, we're going to have it. And I hope maybe one day my daughter looks in this archive and she says, I was proud of my dad.
You know, it's interesting because we're at a time when newspapers everywhere are collapsing and investigative reporting is threatened. You feel optimistic about what the media can do.
They are collapsing. They're collapsing, and they were slow to pick it up. I mean, they didn't even realize giving their content away for free was going to kill them. You know what I mean? They're very hidebound in old institutions. But without them and that sort of in-depth journalism, I say this to people. I say, you don't know anything. Like, media, I can't trust the media. I hate the media. So you don't know anything till the media tells you. You know what I mean? It's very few people going into the archives of the buildings department and looking at that contract. You know, Kwame Kilpatrick here, our mayor on federal racketeering charges, that didn't come out because somebody told. That was because reporters did their work. So I'm always going to be a Times man. I'm always a newspaper man. I always believe in doing right, Bob? My shout out to Bob Shuttlebauer, the guy I work with, the cameraman and editor. We do an enormous amount of journalism before we even press the button. But having said that, once you press the button, I got a rule. There's two rules to this whole game called journalism. Get it right and don't be boring. Because if you're boring, you're dead. And I'll say it this way. Press is written into the Constitution like the judiciary, the executive, and the legislative, except they didn't leave us any money. We have to find our own money to do it. And so if people don't want to purchase your product, you're dead. So I like Borat. I like Jackass. I like Charles Kuralt. I like Colbert. I like 60 Minutes. I like Kitty Cats and YouTube. Put them all together, shake it up, and man, give me something. Give me something smart and give me something entertaining. That's my mantra.
Charlie LaDuff's new book is called Detroit, An American Autopsy. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Dave Davies online at freshair.npr.org. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. British singer-songwriter Richard Thompson is as well known for his acoustic folk music as he is for electric rock. Music critic Ken Tucker says Thompson's new album, called Electric, is a strong collection of songs that shows off Thompson's many moods.
South at Sunday, skies are weeping, dawn is creeping through the blind. South at Sunday, and I'm aching for the night I left behind. South at Sunday.
Delicate phrasing with both voice and guitar have always made Richard Thompson a musician well worth listening to, and sometimes even liking him. For a man who can make such pretty music, it's to his credit that he prefers to show his thorny, stubborn, cranky, even mean side in many of the songs in his solo career. Indeed, ever since going through a divorce now 3 decades old from Linda Thompson after they made their masterpiece of their career, 1982's Shoot Out the Lights, Thompson's songwriting has returned again and again to his, shall we say, complex relations with women.
Got her ducks all in a row. Got her bags all packed to go. She'll find some other poor pilgrim who's braver. At least she'll look me in the eye with her last and fond goodbye. Well, that's one small thing in a favor.
That's Another Small Thing in Her Favor, a lovely song about breaking up with not a little rancor. As the title makes clear, the narrator will give the woman some credit, but only grudgingly. When Thompson isn't working in peak form, this recurring theme can become tiresome. But this time around, working with producer Buddy Miller, who mostly favors spare settings for Thompson's guitar and voice, the new songs have a crisp clarity that rings out most of the self-righteousness. 2 songs stand out in particular. The first is Stony Ground, in which the 63-year-old Thompson imagines a codger older than himself, still feeling goatish and erotically greedy, and still getting poked in the nose for his urges. The result is what might happen if Philip Roth wrote the lyrics for a song with roots in British folk music.
He lost his heart to Bucks and Betty, throwing up the compliments like confetti. Left and right, he threw them all around, but everything was landing on stony ground. A silly old man with his teeth all gone, poking his nose where it don't belong. She's a rose, all right, but she's got thorns. You're working on stony.
The other immediately striking song on this album, Electric, is one of its few flat-out rock songs, one that puts the electricity in the album's title. Good Things Happen to Bad People is another She Done Him Wrong song, but it courses with the energy of the enraged, the revulsion of a realist. Listen to the way Thompson belts out the chorus that good things happen to bad people, even as he prays just as fervently that karma exists for revenge. Then he lets his guitar do the rest of the loud, dirty, catchy work. Good Things Happen to Bad People is a good song happening to a singer-songwriter who is perpetually circling great work. And this album, Electric, is, in general, the testament of a frequently angry coot still coming to terms with the sources of his frustrations, which, I hope, ought to give him material for many more years to come.
Ken Tucker is Fresh Air's pop music critic. He reviewed Richard Thompson's new album, Electric. After a quick break, we'll hear the interview Terry Gross recorded with jazz musician Annette Cohen. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to part of Terry's interview with Israeli-born jazz clarinetist, saxophone player, and composer Annette Cohen. She grew up in Tel Aviv, played in the Israeli Air Force Band, and moved to the U.S. to study at the Berklee College of Music in Boston. Cohen now lives in New York and has become one of the top clarinetists in American jazz. Let's start with a track from Annette Cohen's latest album, Clarascuro. Jason Lidner is featured on piano.
That's Levion Rose from Annette Cohen's new album, Clarascuro. Annette Cohen, welcome to Fresh Air. I love your playing. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Terry. It's great to be here.
So, at our request, you brought your clarinet with you.
I do have it in my hand.
And because you have such a beautiful tone, and an especially warm tone in the lower register, can you just play a little bit in the lower register and talk about the difference between the lower and the upper register for you as a musician?
Sure. Well, because I also play the tenor saxophone, sometimes I like to bring the tenor saxophone vibe into the clarinet. So while you would hear in a more of a classical setting, the clarinet in the lower register would sound like that. But what I would do, I would take the subtone technique from the tenor saxophone, which maybe the legit clarinetists, they don't necessarily approve of, and I would make the lower register sound like this. So it has a lot of variety.
So what you just did has more, it's more breathy, there's more vibrato.
Exactly. There's more air, and you know, if you imagine Ben Webster on the tenor saxophone, then you can apply this whole lot of air and vibrato, and I love doing it on the clarinet. Now, yes, it's maybe it's kind of a no-no in the clarinet world, in the legit way of playing. But you know, when you play jazz, the search for expression that's what it's about. And if I want to say something and whisper it, and you know, the air has an effect. I mean, you know, it's like you're talking to someone and you're like, you know, when you speak with more air in your voice, it gives a certain feeling. So, you know, it's just another vocabulary of sound.
And you mentioned in the legit world, in the classical music world, vibrato and breathiness, at least the size of the vibrato that you just played, and breathiness is discouraged. and you started in the conservatory when you were, you know, when you were 12, so you were trained that way. Yeah,
right. But I think because I moved to the tenor saxophone and I focused on the tenor saxophone for so many years, then I went back to the clarinet. I said, why not apply those techniques into the clarinet, the ones that I learned to play on the saxophone. Mm-hmm. So I think I'm just borrowing from the saxophone world.
Now, what about in the upper register? What do you think about there?
Well, the upper register of the clarinet can be quite painful.
Painful as in squeaky?
Not necessarily squeaky, but painful because it's very direct sound. Now I'm going to try, and just make sure you plug your ears, okay? With some earplugs. Okay, I'm playing really loud, really, really soft actually, but I can play louder. Now you can use let's say you take something from the klezmer, you bend the notes from the klezmer world, and you go like, so you can apply or you can use like really big vibrato on the higher register. So you know, it's really such an expressive instrument. And for playing jazz, actually, it's great because when you play with other people and everybody's into the moment and you want to add something to the sound rather than playing, then using all those sound techniques really help the expression.
Since we've been talking about clarinet versus saxophone, maybe we should hear you on saxophone, because there's a great track on your new album, Chiaroscuro, in which you do an Abdullah Ibrahim piece called The Wedding. Why don't you tell us why you chose this, and maybe talk a little bit about your approach on tenor, since we just heard you describe your approach on clarinet.
Well, we recorded The Wedding, actually, pianist Jason Linder suggested that we play this song, and that was a couple of years ago when we went to play in South Africa in a jazz festival in Joburg. And since Abdullah Ibrahim is from South Africa, Jason suggested to play this song, and I immediately fell in love with it, and it became a part of our repertoire. And you know, the tenor saxophone for me has so much history. Every note that I play on the tenor saxophone is coming from one of the great fathers of the tenor saxophone. So there's a mixture of sounds and a little gospel and some, you know, backbeat, a little bit of R&B, and just like a lot of tradition. So The Wedding has a little bit of everything.
Okay, so this is Annette Cohn on tenor saxophone. Jason Lindner is the pianist, and it's from Annette Cohn's new album, Chiaroscuro. ¶¶ That's The Wedding, a composition by Abdullah Ibrahim, and it's from Annette Cohn's new album, Chiaroscuro, and she's featured on tenor saxophone and clarinet on this new album. Now, you grew up in Israel. You've been living in the United States since about 1996, when you came here to study at the Berklee School of Music. Mm-hmm. How were you first exposed to jazz in Israel?
Well, actually, I have two brothers that are jazz musicians, and it was definitely a family journey. The three of us went to the same schools and the same conservatory and the same after-school youth orchestra and big band rehearsals, and also we were all part of the conservatory in Tel Aviv, Jaffa, playing the music of New Orleans. There was twice a week a Dixieland band, and that really was my exposure to jazz.
Dixieland.
Playing the music of New Orleans. Now, I didn't know, I could play some clarinet and I could read music, but I really knew nothing about improvisation. But luckily, they have music charts with written solos, and I could just focus on the feeling of swing, which is so new to me because, you know, that's not what you hear normally on the radio in Israel. So I just fell in love with the way it felt.
So you've just walked us into the next recording I want to play, and this is from one of the albums you've recorded with your two brothers, with Avishai on trumpet and Yuval on soprano saxophone, and the recording is Tiger Rag, one of the popular trad jazz songs. And in this, you kind of combine a little bit of klezmer along with like traditional New Orleans jazz. Do you want to talk about your arrangement for this version of Tiger Rag?
Sure. Basically, we were invited, the three Cohens, my two brothers and myself, we have a sextet, and we were invited to play in Brazil, and the theme of the festival in Ouro Preto, Brazil, was Louis Armstrong. And we all love Louis. And we said, okay, we're each going to make some arrangements and something else, different angle of Louis Armstrong, stuff that he recorded. And I chose Tiger Rag because it's just such a traditional song. And I realized that it's really playful. You can get to give it a little bit of like klezmer feel. And I was really trying to go from a little like one big Egyptian orchestra moment and to traditional New Orleans feeling, to Baião feeling, northeast of Brazil. Try to make it really playful because this song has traditionally been taken really, really seriously, and it was always a real cutting competition between musicians. So I was just trying to have some fun with it.
So this is Tiger Rag, arranged by my guest, clarinetist and saxophonist Annette Cohn. She's featured on clarinet on this, and it's from the Three Cohens album, Family. My guest, Annette Cohn's arrangement of Tiger Rag. She was featured on clarinet. It's from the album Family, featuring the three Cohns. Annette Cohn, her brother Yuval Cohn was on soprano saxophone, and her other brother Avishai Cohn on trumpet. So it's interesting that in New York now, you're one of several Israeli jazz musicians who have become very popular. And I'm thinking, just to name a couple, you, your brother, Avishai Cohn, the trumpeter, and Nat Fort. Mm-hmm. What is it that now there's like a group of Israeli musicians who are making names for themselves in American jazz. I can't say that happened much until the last few years.
I think there are two ways to look at it. One is that maybe the possibility that Israel has produced more jazz musicians than before because of the education in Israel that in schools that teach jazz and programs that schools in Israel have as affiliated with Berklee College of Music and with the New School in New York. So people have more of a direct line to come to the United States to pursue their career and to study. And I think the mainstream media in the U.S. or maybe in general, they're just more open to foreigners. And it's okay today to be a jazz musician from another country and to be a real voice in this American art form called jazz.
Annette Cohen's latest album is called Claroscuro. You'll find a longer version of her interview with Terry Gross online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Nell Beschenstein is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.